Good morning again. Please be seated. This is case number 56056, Michelle Taylor versus State of Nevada. Mr. Bergerson and Ms. Patrick for the appellant, Mr. Thompson for the respondent. I understand you're going to go 5 minutes, Mr. Bergerson, and then Ms. Patrick will go 5 minutes, and then you'll save 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
And we're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Don Bergerson. I greet you from San Francisco, California, and I thank you for allowing me to appear in Pro Hac for Ms. Taylor. I want to address the two issues in this case that concern the more structural aspects of it. Ms. Kilpatrick is going to be addressing some of the more specific evidentiary issues. My two issues are intertwined with one another, although I will, of course, answer questions on them separately. As I see it, the citizens of Nevada have reserved for themselves in their jury trial system two fundamental rights that ensure that their verdicts are generally verdicts, in other words, fair and true statements of the facts of the case. The first right that they have reserved for themselves is a practice that is not unique to Nevada, but is exceptionally well implemented here, and that is the practice of allowing counts to be pleaded in the alternative such that the jury can find the gravamen of what actually happened in the case and, using themselves as the conscience of the community, reach a true verdict as to what the real significant facts of the case are. That system, unfortunately, broke down here because of an instruction that was given by the court that was an error under this court's doctrine in the Green case. As a result of that error, Ms. Taylor ended up convicted of the one remaining count, the count that carries a life imprisonment sentence. And it is our contention that that sentence is unconstitutional as applied to Ms. Taylor because it is so shockingly severe, given the nature of her conduct, as to offend against both the Eighth Amendment and Article I, Section 8 of the Nevada Constitution.
Counsel, let me ask you this. I know you're going to talk about the Green case, and I'm interested why you think unable to agree versus unable to conclude is so significant. But before we do that, on the constitutionality issue, if we agree with your argument, and we spent a lot of time looking at this and analyzing the constitutional issues, wouldn't we have to strike down this lewdness statute as being unconstitutional? Because the only penalty provided in that statute is the 10 to life for your first offense and then a life without for a second offense. And
I don't believe so. This is a unique case, kind of a first impression.
Tell me why we wouldn't have to strike the statute down.
Because we're not challenging the statute. We believe that the penalty provided for by the statute is intrinsically acceptable for the crime of lewd conduct with a minor. It's simply that under the facts of this case, Ms. Taylor's conduct was so, I don't want to say lightweight or anything, but so at the low end of the offensive spectrum in this case as to constitute cruel and unusual punishment as to her. And this court, as a court reviewing an Eighth Amendment and an Article I, Section 8 challenge, is empowered to pass such sentences as appropriate under the circumstances. Certainly, what suggests itself is to pass a sentence that is essentially on the other count. Reverse in order for that count to be jointly tried, strike the statutory reference to the lewd conduct charge as to Ms. Taylor on grounds that the punishment provided for under it is excessive, and then allow proceedings to take their course. I assume she would end up serving either the 1 to 5 or 2 to 10 years that the other statute provides for. That certainly is one remedy. It's not particularly unusual to do something like that. But okay, so that's my answer to your first question. Now, you said you wanted to ask me, because I have limited time, about what the difference
about
is.
About the Green instruction, you know, and again, I think doesn't this revolve around the unable to agree language of Green versus unable to conclude used here? And is am I misphrasing it, or I'll let you go ahead?
I don't believe you're misphrasing it. It's one of the fortunes and misfortunes of the law that everything kind of tends to sound the same. So you have language that is designed to be an instruction, and it sometimes sounds similar to other language. The phrase unable to agree means that there is no unanimity between 12 jurors. That is the appropriate instruction under Green. That's the appropriate instruction here. That means that each individual juror is allowed to express his conscientious vote as to what truly happened in the case. That is what Nevada's charging in the alternative allows jurors to do. Unable to conclude means that the jury as a whole cannot conclude that the case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. It's addressed to the jury, not to individual jurors.
But under our standard for plain error, how would that How would you meet that threshold?
Well, I have two answers to that question. The first is that what was said was said, and this can come before a court as a writ of habeas corpus, or it can come before the court on this record, which is the same record as would come before the court on a habeas corpus. The question is the instruction adequate to have given the jury its fair notice as to what the jury was supposed to? It is my opinion that if you say, and the opinion of the defense, it's not my opinion, that if one says if the jury is unable to conclude the case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, that is essentially an instruction telling the jury they must acquit before they can proceed forward. Okay, and I believe that that's what it is. Under plain error, the error has to be the same as it would be if the objection had been lodged. It's the question of prejudice, and I can certainly address that, but obviously the two offenses are different in their gravamen. One of them, the lewd conduct, is a specific intent statute involving minors under 14 carrying life imprisonment. The other is a general intent statute, at least as it would be applied here, with the filtering of it being an intent crime, an attempt crime, so there's a certain element of specific intent, but not the lewd specific intent. And that crime would be different if the jury were to have concluded that the gravamen of what happened was that Ms. Taylor was attempting to have sex with the minor, which appears to be how the minor interpreted it. That was what he cried out. That's why he left.
Let me ask you one other thing, if you want to address it, or Ms. Kilpatrick can. In looking at this case, this involves Ms. Taylor. It was 34, I guess, when she was sentenced. I don't know what age she was when this offense occurred, 33 or 34.
32, yeah.
The boy involved was 13.
Yes.
So if you took the facts of this case, and let's reverse it and say it was a 33 or 34-year-old man with a 13-year-old girl, and this happened here, would that be an appropriate sentence here under that situation? Same set of facts, just reverse the genders here.
Well, I have to say, and I'm not trying to be facetious, it's hard to get a fungible equivalent because, you know, touching a man's chest is not the same as fondling a woman's breast. But if what you mean is that there's some sort of lascivious but non-genital touching with clothes, I think it would be offensive. I believe the defense would believe it would be offensive. It would shock the conscience. Perhaps it might shock the conscience differently. Perhaps the method of emotional analysis would be different, but the constitutional analysis would be the same.
Okay,
thank that would you. Be my answer to your questions. I'm sorry we have little time, and I'll give this to Ms. Kilpatrick.
Thank you, Ms. Kilpatrick.
I'm leaving this up for her.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Alina Kilpatrick from the Public Defender's Office in Elko, and I'd like to talk to you about the evidentiary issues and problems that presented in this case. The text messages, the abstract of the judgment of conviction, and the school photograph of the complaining witness of the victim. With regard to the text messages, since text messages have become the preferred communication for our more youthful citizens, this court has not addressed their admissibility. And they present some unique questions as far as admissibility. First off, you never know whose fingers are on the other end of the phone. Anyone can pick up anyone's phone and text anything he or she wants. The ABA instructs us to make sure that our phones are secured or password protected, but the average person doesn't do that. So when we're entering a text message as an admission by a party opponent or as an admission by a defendant, how do we even know that the defendant is the one that actually wrote the text message? Now, this particular case had many issues with the text messages specifically. First off, we had an in-trial motion to suppress. During the trial, the arresting deputy testified that he arrested Ms. Taylor as a result of speaking with the younger victim's mother. In his report, what he had said was that he had spoken to the victim first. So what happened was I made an in-trial motion to suppress at that time based upon the fact that the arresting deputy didn't have probable cause to arrest. And the court struck it down as untimely. Unfortunately, trial counsel had no way of knowing that the deputy was going to completely change his testimony. And what the court decided was it decided to reference its previous order regarding a completely different issue with the text messages, which was a patent issue. The reason why this presents a problem is because the court did not have an evidentiary hearing, did not make findings of fact, so there's nothing for this court to review regarding that.
Another issue. Did you ask for an evidentiary hearing at that point in the trial?
As I was moving to suppress them, and as I was moving to suppress them, the court just struck it down and said, they're admitted, and I find the deputy had probable cause. Continue. And that presents the second issue. The second
deputy's testimony came as a surprise to you, and you reacted to it.
Yes.
It's essentially.
I jumped up and down and made my objection, and the court said, yeah, no, let's keep going, which presents a second issue. The court ruled them admitted while I was arguing the objection, and when that happened, the state had not had the opportunity to lay even the most fundamental basic foundation. Deputy, are these the pictures of the text messages that you actually took? And the second issue was, are they in the same or substantially the same condition as they were when they were written and sent, which presents another problem. The deputy testified that a phone is like a computer. Any computer saves its information somewhere, whether it be on a removable storage device like a SIM card, or whether it be on the server of the cellular carrier. What we did learn throughout the trial was that, yes, the sheriff's office did have the ability to retrieve the text messages directly from the phone company, but they didn't. So we have no way to authenticate them. And that goes into the best evidence problem. The photographs of the text messages are clearly not the best evidence.
Well, let me ask you this. Assuming we agreed with you, why isn't this error harmless?
The error is not harmless because of the nature of the case and the trial testimony. We had conflicting trial testimony. We had the little boy's testimony, which drastically conflicted with Ms. Taylor's mother's testimony. And without those text messages, you had a kid versus an adult. And those text messages, if you read them contextually, were very damaging on behalf of Ms. Taylor.
Ms. Taylor did testify at the trial, didn't she?
She did testify at the trial.
So she would have had the ability to deny sending those texts if she didn't send them.
Correct. By the time we had Ms. Taylor testify, though, the court had...
I realize they had ruled, but she could have, since she chose to testify, she could have got up and said, look, I never sent those texts, and go on, and you could argue that is a factual issue for the jury to sort out. Then.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. That is procedurally very correct. So we have a best evidence issue, and going on towards Ms. Taylor's testimony, the state impeached Ms. Taylor with a judgment of conviction that was not really a judgment of conviction.
I don't want to derail you here,
sure,
but
no problem.
Going back to the text message mm-hmm. issue, for a best evidence issue error to be problematic, there usually is some dispute as to the authenticity of what was actually admitted. And I wanted you to comment, if you would, on the broken chain of evidence with respect to the missing cell phone. It gets...
Yes, that presents a huge problem because with regard to best evidence, you know, a duplicate is admissible if you can relate it back to an original. We don't have an original for comparison. That's a problem. With regard to the chain of custody, and the reason why this error is cumulative regarding these text messages is because the phone pretty much, according to record, vanished for a year. And somehow or another, it grew legs and walked in and out of the evidence locker. It's particularly disturbing that Detective Landon, who photographed the phone and handled the phone, is nowhere on the chain of custody. He's on the chain of custody for when he took the phone out for trial, but he's nowhere on it for when he actually examined the phone. Anyone could have examined the phone, deleted text messages, changed text messages, saved things to draft. We don't know. And because the chain of custody was about as strong as wet toilet paper, you've got, on the other hand, the fact that you don't have originals for comparison, and the authenticity, the admissibility, everything regarding the text messages goes down the drain because it's all linked together.
And are the text messages, the content of them, germane to the specific intent required for lewdness?
If I may inquire, so is the court asking me if the text messages contained any admissions regarding the lewdness or any intent regarding the lewdness.
Right. What, the content of the text messages, did they add to the state's proof with respect to this defendant's specific intent to excite or arouse either herself or her victim?
Not with regard to the specific intent, but she did admit to possibly offending the victim and to doing something wrong, and that's how the text messages ended up becoming harmful error, and I'd like to save the rest of time for rebuttal. Thank you.
I'll give you a few
minutes. To take some
time.
Thompson? Or the state of Nevada?
Good morning. My name is Chad Thompson. I am the deputy district attorney who charged this case as well as tried the case. February 22nd was the first day in 2008 that Michelle Taylor and this young boy, this 13-year-old victim, had ever met. And at this point, they're both regretting that they ever met because of the actions of Ms. Taylor at that time. They have cited multiple issues, and they've talked about them in a little bit different order than I possibly anticipated. But I wanted to address first their first issue of the unconstitutionality of this particular sentence as applied to Ms. Taylor. The case that they cite is Graham and Harmelin. Those are the cases that allow for the proportionality or gross proportionality type analysis that this court must go through. And there's a threshold decision that has to be made first. And they say in the rare case in which this threshold comparison, and they're talking about whether or not the gravity of the offense and the severity of the sentence is grossly disproportionate, you have to get an inference of gross disproportionality before you move on to the other parts of the test, which was the interjurisdiction and another jurisdiction type analysis. And to that end, you look at the facts of this particular case. And what we would suggest that this is, they're not arguing sufficiency of the evidence for the conviction, but they are for the sentence. And so what we would suggest is you use the same reasoning from COSA, where you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state and apply it in looking to see whether or not the evidence fits the sentence in this particular case. And in looking at what happened here, when you read through the boy's testimony, he's 13 years old, he's with his younger brother. This is the first day he's ever met Ms. Taylor. She invites them over to her home to play the PlayStation 3. When they get there, the two boys are left in the living room to watch TV, and Ms. Taylor goes into her bedroom. The 13-year-old testified that it was SpongeBob that they were watching. After about 10 minutes or so, he got to wondering if they're going to do the PlayStation, and so he went into Ms. Taylor's room. When he goes into Ms. Taylor's room, she asks him to shut the door and sit down on the bed. When he does this, she pushes him back. He described it as a light push, but a push nonetheless. She pushes him back and gets on top of him, straddles him, is the way he described it. She was wearing a white hooded sweatshirt at the time that, in fact, his mother had given to Ms. Taylor, their friends. She removed that, grabbed the boy's hand, placed it under, all she was wearing at this time was this brown or beige bra, placed it under the bra, and had him touch both of her breasts. She then also kisses him about the head and face, tries to kiss him on the lips, but the boy says he wouldn't let her. She tried to remove his clothing. He was wearing a zip-up sweater. She tried to pull it off his shoulder, and he pulled it back on. He also described her pushing down her pants a little ways. She also told him to have sex with her in more crass terms. And when asked the boy why, if he tried to push her off or do anything, he said he was shocked and he was scared. She was only interrupted or stopped when her mother came into the room. At that point, she jumps up off of the bed and...
Was her mother home when the boys were there?
Her mother was home, and Ivan testifies that while he's, or the younger boy who's out watching television, he testifies that he is out in the room and he sees the mother come out of her bedroom. She was working night shifts. She was getting up to go to work. She went in and took a shower, came out of the shower, and then went into Ms. Taylor's room. When the boy ended up leaving, she flashed him one last time and then collects his little brother, and then they run home.
Was there any evidence there was a bottle of tequila in
there the was. Bars? There was a bottle of tequila in the room. He also said the boy saw her drinking that. But what you have is you have the little boy talking about this time frame while the mother's taking a shower, and when they come out of the room, it's not SpongeBob on the TV anymore. You're talking about a different show. It's called Drake and Josh, I guess. And so what you have, when you analyze these facts in the light most favorable to the state, and even looking at that Rodriguez case that they talked from Oregon, they did not implement the mandatory minimum sentence because of several factors that they found. There was no fondling in that case, no stroking, no rubbing, no palpating. You can't say that of Ms. Taylor here. They found that the contact was minimal or was brief or momentary. You cannot say that about what happened here between Ms. Taylor and this boy. There was no evidence of force or threats of any kind. You cannot say that about Ms. Taylor in this particular instance. In those particular cases, the body parts that were touched were clothed. You cannot say that about Ms. Taylor in this instance. And then they talk about no skin-to-skin contact, again, the same thing. No genital contact in this particular instance, that she sits on him in the straddling position. While it would be through the clothes, it's still a very sexual position. And then they talk about penetration, which wouldn't be an element or something that could be even lewdness. That's specifically excluded for sexual assault. So when you look at those facts, how can this not be lewdness that requires a life sentence?
Well, let me ask the question that appellant raised. What's your position on appellant's claim that we could invalidate the sentence without finding the lewdness statute unconstitutional? What would be the position of the Elko District Attorney's Office in that?
It's our position that basically by making this particular claim that they're making, this is kind of an end run of a facial challenge towards the constitutionality of this statement. We think that you would have to find it unconstitutional and strike the sentence down in order to be able to, invalidate the sentence, in other words.
So we'd have to find the statute unconstitutional as far as the state of Nevada is concerned.
That's what our position would be, yes. Now, in making that threshold determination, there are several things that you can look at, and they talk about those, the gravity of the offense versus the sentence. You talk about the harm to the victim. You talk about the magnitude of the crime, the motive behind it. Her motive is she wanted full-blown sexual intercourse with a 13-year-old boy. That's what she wanted. And she went to all these steps. So the question would be, how far do they have to go? Is the court really going to get into that business where you start going, how far does one have to go in order to implement the sentence? We think that based on that evidence, there's enough to support or sustain this conviction as well as the sentence that goes along with it.
How about her apparent inebriation? How does that play into the specific intent and the circumstances here?
Well, the inebriation was something that she testified to greatly. And the state would suggest that that was in a manner to try and excuse herself from it. There were actually several jury questions as, did you ever pass out? Did you ever get sick? Because she said she drank so much alcohol throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And the reality was, is you had Ms. Espinoza, they had been over at her residence, the boy's mother's residence for a time, and they weren't drinking over there. And so it was our argument that she was basically doing that to try and put forth to the jury a showing that she didn't know what she was doing. It was supportive of the same thing that she told the deputy or the detective when she was interviewed at the jail. She passed out, had no idea. Her memory stopped. Her memory stopped because she passed out when the boy came into the room.
Do you agree with the assertion in the amicus brief that no other jurisdiction in the country requires a mandatory life sentence for lewd conduct with a minor?
I don't agree with that. I think that there are, I think Montana had an extremely serious, when I looked through several of the other statutes, and there were some very serious sentences. But in looking at just Nevada, if you have sexual assault of a child, no substantial bodily harm, it's a 35 to life. And so I don't see how 10 to life, for whatever steps get you to that sexual assault, which she was well on her way there, because this boy wanted nothing to do with her. He said, I want to wait till I'm older.
To what extent were the disproportionality and cruel or unusual, in Nevada's words, arguments made in the trial court in any kind of fashion?
During the sentencing, and I wasn't present for sentencing, but I think that I don't know that it was specifically brought up, and that was one thing that concerned me in this particular case, was that when were we supposed to bring up something to the effect of, for example, the mental harm that we caused to the boy? When were we supposed to be able to put on that portion of evidence? Because I don't have to do that in a lewdness case. I don't have to show any sort of harm as far as mental or physical harm in order to get the conviction. And so it wasn't, the state suggests that it wasn't raised. If so, it was a pleading court of please don't do this. But it wasn't raised per se clearly as the state would have liked, so that if we had to support it in some way by showing some sort of evidence, we weren't allowed to do that.
And then the anecdotal evidence of comparative sentences that other people have received, and Justice Gibbons asked a question I had about that, about if you take gender out of it, where are we with those statistics? But there was no evidentiary hearing or development at all of how others who do comparable acts have been treated by our system.
There was not. In fact, and again, that is more of, you have to get past that threshold finding first.
Granted.
But once you get to that, there wasn't any sort of analysis or anything like that. And when I looked at this case, you look at the Rodriguez one, and let's say you change the age of the child from whatever it was in Rodriguez to whatever. I don't think those courts changed their mind. I think that it was the conduct itself that caused them to do what they did. If you change the participants, the genders, and in fact, in the Rodriguez two cases, you had one male defendant and one female defendant. And so if you do that, in those cases, it still fit that the judges were still going to do that. In this particular case, it seems if Ms. Taylor had done this as a 32-year-old to a 5-year-old boy, nobody would be questioning whatsoever that this would be a life sentence. But now all of a sudden, because it's 13, doesn't the legislature, aren't they the ones who are allowed to set that age? And so, and the same thing with switching the genders. That shouldn't be something that should consider, that the court should consider, at least is our position. It should be a focus on that conduct of what she did while she was in that bedroom with that boy, and that merits a life sentence. With regards to these evidentiary issues,
well, it doesn't. The legislature made the determination that if you're convicted of lewdness, it merits a life sentence. So it doesn't matter what the facts are, so long as the lewdness conviction stands, the legislature's mandated life sentence.
Correct. And so that's where we think that you would have to invalidate the statute. You would have to find it facially unconstitutional in order to overturn that sentence.
Because otherwise, where would you be with the sentencing?
I don't know. I mean, you would have a conviction, but what would be the sentence at that point?
I guess counsel is suggesting we impose one of the lesser offenses there, but I assume your argument is we'd be substituting our judgment for the jury.
Clearly, and there's a big difference between those alternative counts, and we would disagree with counsel, obviously, with regards to the Green instruction. They're saying it was an acquit first, but there's no unanimous language. It doesn't say you must unanimously conclude. That was the instruction that's missing there. The other thing about that particular argument is the substantial rights of the defendant weren't thwarted by that instruction because the facts were identical. The only difference between count one and count two was whether or not the jury thought this boy was 14 years old or 13 years old. That's it. That was the only difference. That's the only thing that we argued, and there was zero testimony whatsoever to contradict that he was 13 years old. Nothing whatsoever. So there was really no error. Even if it was an acquit first instruction, there's nothing there because the facts were identical.
What about the cell phone? Why wasn't it produced for the defense so they could examine the card or whatever it is that keeps track of all these text messages?
The cell phone was in evidence the entire time. They could have done whatever. They made no motion whatsoever in order for us to produce it.
I thought it was missing for a while.
It was not missing. When we asked them to go get it, they sure knew right where it was. The state would suggest it was probably just a matter of somebody didn't sign the chain of custody, a piece of paper.
Why didn't you bring the cell phone? I mean, you said it was.
We had it. It was there at trial. We didn't admit it at trial.
Why did you use the photocopies of the messages versus I don't know how you print them out, come to think of it. I wouldn't know. I guess, so the jury, you're saying the cell phone was there.
We had
for the jury, was it admitted into evidence?
No, and the concern there, and this was something that you'll find in the record, that we both agreed not to put it into evidence because there might be other things on the cell phone. We don't want the jury thumbing through. If it's one of those cell phones you can hop on the internet, we don't want them to have it.
But it is a bit disturbing because we don't have the original telephone company record of the text messages, which would include things that might have been deleted. If you assume, and I'm not saying anyone did this, but let's say for the sake of argument, somebody went into that cell phone and deleted a lot of the messages that gave all of that context. Say, you know, I'm sorry I offended him, I'm very worried about it, I went off on a tirade cussing other and used real language and I'm terribly sorry. Let's say all of that explanation was taken out and we just had I deeply offended him and I'm terribly sorry left. The telephone, the provider company would have the record of all the deleted language as well as what's remaining on the phone. I think that's the best evidence point that's being made here, and that's the tie-in, that's the problem to the chain of custody. That's what my concern is. So could you comment on that? I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay. It's basically what you had is you had the officer who viewed the text messages as they were being sent back and forth. You had the mother there, and she was texting back and forth to Ms. Taylor, and the mother testified that she texted back and forth.
Okay.
We had been through at a motion to limine hearing prior to trial, we had been through that where we admitted the mother's text messages from her phone. So the court had already been able to see the text messages from both phones, seeing where they're coming from.
And they matched.
And they matched to the extent that we had pictures of them. The deputy didn't take a zillion pictures. We would have preferred more. But to a large extent, the ones that he had, I think all of them that he had matched exactly with what was on her phone. And there was no evidence of tampering whatsoever from anybody. There was just nothing. All you have really is a chain of custody sheet that probably wasn't filled out.
Well, can I ask you one other question about the abstract of judgment and the authentication of that? It's my understanding there was some telephone testimony, but was it Mr. Jenkins or something from Indiana?
Ms. Jenkins, if I recall.
Yeah, Ms. From Indiana. Now, what type of proceeding was that where that testimony took place?
Again, that was the motion in limine hearing. We wanted to use that. Indiana happens to call them abstracts of judgment. It has all of the right things for it. I don't believe that it was admitted at trial, though. We just had this as the offer of proof hearing prior to trial. She testified via the telephone and said that's what they call them in Indiana. That's what they do.
And okay, she was impeached with it, so I assume it was admitted.
Well, basically, what it was is she was asked while she was on the stand, is we had it on hand, but it was not admitted at trial. So when we impeach someone, we have to ask them, are you a convicted felon? You can only ask the question if you have it. And she, of course, didn't deny it, so it was never offered.
I see. I got it. Now, that telephone testimony, was that there was no objection to that? Both sides agreed to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Kilpatrick, Ms. Burson, I'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. I have a very brief time for rebuttal, so I'll try and be as quick as I can. First of all, question being, can the court overturn this sentence without overturning the statute as unconstitutional? Of course. That's Harmelin versus Michigan. That's what the Supreme Court says you can do. You look and see if a sentence is grossly disproportionate, and you strike it. Now, if what that means is that you tell the court on remand it cannot give her life imprisonment and she's somehow an exception to the statute, that's one way of doing it. I came up with another way of doing it.
Can we do it for burglary cases and grand larceny cases, too? I mean, should we be resentencing defendants? Like if somebody gets, you know, a lengthy sentence for a grand larceny where there wasn't a lot stolen, should we do that? Should we be doing that?
You shouldn't, because it's not a good reason to invalidate a sentence to start with. But beyond that, you as a court, a Supreme Court, are empowered to strike a sentence if it is grossly disproportionate, and then you go on to the other analysis in Harmelin. Assuming for the sake of discussion that you have done that and you have decided that this sentence, in which no clothes are removed, the boy is not physically restrained, there's no threats made to him, there's no genital touching, there's none of that kind of stuff, there's evidence of mitigation and that the defendant is intoxicated, and you find that the groping of the breast coupled with the, pardon my French, fuck me command, is not worthy of life imprisonment, then the sentence is stricken. That's what Harmelin versus Michigan says. What the trial court chooses to do with it then is
up to the trial court. And there will, I don't know, there could be a fruitless appeal if the trial court reduces the sentence significantly but not down to nothing. That may happen. But certainly the question is your choice only to let an unconstitutional sentence stand or not? You can't let an unconstitutional sentence stand. That's the duty of the court to strike down, and you're told that by the United States Supreme Court in Harmelin versus Michigan and Weems and all the other Eighth Amendment cases that are non-categorical challenges. The Graham makes it clear. Some challenges are categorical. Some challenges are sentence-specific. This is a sentence-specific challenge. My suggestion doesn't have to be the one you adopt, but it's the appropriate one appropriate way of doing it. The other is simply to strike the sentence and remand it to the trial court, this time to exercise discretion. A couple of other questions arose. Was there an objection made to the sentence? Yes. The objection was fairly shrieked by Ms. Kilpatrick at the time that the sentence was taken. She said, you're giving this woman more time than if she had murdered the boy. The thing went viral on the internet. It's very much covered. Of course there was an objection to cruel and unusual punishment, and pretty much every other constitutional objection except for quartering soldiers in a home during time of peace. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that Ms. Kilpatrick said. In terms of the phone, there was
I'm not quarreling whether there was an objection, but the issue of how other jurisdictions treat this similar offense was not developed.
That is an appellate way of reviewing a sentence. It might arguably be good. It might be good trial practice for a lawyer to go and make those arguments, but those are appellate challenges that a court of appeal or a Supreme Court makes when looking at a sentence, not necessarily what trial counsel has to say. What we did have was evidence that this woman was not dangerous, and if the state wanted to produce evidence that there was trauma, the state could have, the state didn't. And the victim was quite calm when he testified. I'm not saying, nobody's asking you to give her a daycare license. Nobody's asking you to give her a reward. We're asking you to give her a substantial amount of time in prison, just not life. Okay, I'm out of time. I don't want to go into negative time. If you have any other questions, though, it's an important
case. Any other questions? Yeah, there's a note from your co-counsel. Why don't you take a look at it? Justice Gibbons called that to my attention. I didn't even see that. Go ahead.
Ms. Kilpatrick informs me, and you have the record, that she did mention other cases at the time of sentencing. She did do an attempted cross comparison.
Okay.
So, and that's in the record. I can't speak to that except for the
thank you very much.
Thank you for your courtesy and for the extra time.
Mr. Thompson, Ms. Kilpatrick.